My name is Greg Dick, and I'm the Director of Educational Outreach here at PI, and it is my pleasure to welcome you all here today. I would like to welcome our live audience here in the theater. I would like to welcome those of you watching online, and I'd like to welcome those viewers across Canada watching on TVO. I'd like to make a special note of thanks to our partners, BMO, TVO, and the beautiful screen behind me, Christie Digital. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce to you one of PI's very own researchers and faculty members, Dr. Natalia Toro. Natalia Toro completed her PhD in 2007 at Harvard under the supervision of Nima Arkini Ahmad, a distinguished research chair here at Perimeter Institute, and then continued to complete her postdoctoral fellowship at Stanford University. Natalia joined the PI faculty in September of 2010. Her research focuses on finding new ways to test our understanding of the fundamental laws of nature. She has pioneered a framework called a few parameter models of new physics signals at the LHC at CERN. This framework is being used to digest and understand the data stream coming from the LHC. She is a spokesperson for the A-Prime experiment, APEX, at the Thomas Jefferson National Accelerator Facility in Virginia, which announced its first scientific findings in August of 2011. Natalia works at the intersection of theory and hard data. She will explain today how complex collision data from the LHC is being digested and examined, and how it may set a new course for the future of science. Please join me in welcoming Natalia Toro on her talk, Smash, Bang, Boom, The Fundamental Physics of the LHC. Dr. Natalia Toro.
Hi. So thanks, everybody, for coming out here today for the grand opening of the Stephen Hawking Center. It's a real privilege for me to be able to tell you a little bit about the physics that's going on at the LHC, what we're learning from it. What you see on the screen now is an actual picture of a proton collision at the LHC taken in the first few months that it was running. And what's remarkable about this picture is that every single line on it corresponds to a single subatomic particle that can actually be individually resolved by the detector. So I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about these particles, how we know what they are, and what they've taught us about the structure of the world. Then about the Large Hadron Collider itself, how it works, how it creates these new particles, and finally, what we hope to learn from these collisions. But I should actually start before people even realized that the world was made up of particles at all. Down in the basement of the Royal Institution in London, Michael Faraday was studying the properties of electricity and magnetism and creating the foundations of the theory that powers our world today. He was studying electricity going through many things, through solids, through liquids, through gases. And when he ran electricity through gases, he found something really surprising. Actually, the electricity through the gas seemed to light up a little arc of light inside of the gas tube, of the glass tube holding the gas. Nobody knew what this was. And over the decades that followed, people tried to understand it, in part, by building glass tubes with less and less gas in them, decreasing the pressure and seeing how this phenomenon changed. Geissler made a tube with 1,000 times less gas in it. And instead of a single arc through the tube, the entire tube glowed with light. And then, with even lower pressures of gas inside, that glow started going away. With low enough pressure, the glow completely disappeared. But Crookes found that with a little sheet of paint on the phosphorescent paint on the edge of the tube, that paint would actually get lit up by something going through the tube. It was as if the glow had moved to the end. And what's more, there was a shadow cast. So when an object was put inside of the tube, it cast a shadow on the end of the tube, like something was passing from one end to the other. Now, these look like foreign archaic objects to most of us, but Geissler's tube is really no different from a neon sign. And Crookes's cathode rays formed the basis of television screens, computer monitors that have been used until very recently in all our everyday lives. But to really understand fundamentally what was going on in these cathode ray tubes took very systematic experiments by many people, but in particular, J.J. Thomson in the Cavendish Laboratory. And he did very precise measurements of how electric and magnetic forces acted on these cathode rays. He found that they did affect them and realized that they were actually made up of a new kind of particle, something much lighter than the atoms. And in fact, he found these particles, after he discovered them in the cathode rays, popping up in lots of other places. So he realized, at a time when atoms were just starting to be understood, he realized that those cathode rays were really electrons, the building blocks of atoms. And this was the beginning of a real revolution in our understanding of nature. For hundreds of years, people have been piecing together the story of chemistry and how different chemical elements seem to have different properties, but there were some commonalities, leading to the periodic table. All of this structure had been understood by 1932 as coming from a quantum mechanical interaction of three basic building blocks: the electron discovered by Thomson, the proton, and finally the neutron, making up all of these atoms and unifying in a simple way why they had such different properties. Now, many questions remained, even in this theory, in particular, the puzzle of radioactive decays. But this was a real starting point. Now, I want to explain a little bit about the electrical and magnetic effects that Thomson used to discover the electron. Because believe it or not, these are the very same effects that are used in the Large Hadron Collider today to probe a new frontier of physics. Electric forces accelerate a particle in the direction of the electric field. So if you have a voltage, a negative electrode, positive electrode, an electron, which is negatively charged, gets pulled away from the negative towards the positive, accelerates forward. A proton would go the other way. Likewise, a magnetic force bends particles. It doesn't move them forward. A particle that's already moving gets bent. And actually, the amount of bending goes like 1 over the momentum of the particle. So the faster a particle goes, the less it gets bent. And the direction, once again, is set by the charge. It's this last fact, that the direction of bending depends on a particle's charge, that led Carl Anderson to discover the positron, a particle that behaved just like the electron in every way and had the same mass, but it had the opposite charge. In a magnetic field, it bent the other way. And here you see the track in a detector of a positron bending, as Anderson discovered it. Now, this particle had actually been predicted a couple of years before by Paul Dirac. He had just written the first theory that successfully united Einstein's special relativity on one hand with quantum mechanics on the other. This theory predicted that every particle that had a charge, the electron, the proton, and others that weren't yet discovered, had to have an antiparticle with exactly this property, an electric charge opposite and all other effects basically the same. In Dirac's theory, E equals mc squared, Einstein's famous equation, really got teeth. It wasn't just an equivalence of energy and mass. They were really interchangeable. They could be exchanged one for the other. An electron and a positron brought together could turn their mass into a burst of energy in the form of light. Going in the other direction, very energetic particles could be brought together, and that energy could be converted into mass of new particles to discover things that had never been seen before. So why not do that in a lab? And this is what people worked on. And just a few snapshots of a small cyclotron built in Berkeley in 1931. A collider at SLAC, one of the early experiments that actually collided two beams of accelerated particles instead of just colliding one beam of particles into a plate of material, and led to a couple of fundamental discoveries, as well as the Tevatron, the second highest energy collider ever built near Chicago, where the discovery of the top quark, the last discovery so far of a fundamental particle, was made. This top quark and all the discoveries that led up to it form the basis of what we call the Standard Model, and it's really our new periodic table of the world. So it includes many unfamiliar elements, but I'm going to break it down to the basics first. These are the building blocks of this room. Electrons, we already talked about. We know the electromagnetic forces from our everyday lives. But what are these new things? On the left, there are two quarks. They're called the up quark and the down quark. And on the right, a new force, the strong interaction. You might wonder, if this thing is so strong, why don't we ever see it like we see electromagnetism? The reason is actually that it's so strong that it binds everything that's charged under it together very tightly. You can try to pull these things apart. You can pull an up quark, say, out of a proton, which is built of two up quarks and a down quark. But as you pull it, this requires a significant amount of energy. The energy required to pull it keeps growing the further you pull it out, till eventually you've stored enough energy in the system by pulling that you can turn that energy into a quark-antiquark pair. So by creating matter out of energy, you've now brought that proton back closer together again. Now there's a new proton and a quark-antiquark pair over there. And again, all the strong forces are shielded away from our everyday view. This, it turns out, is also the reason why, in a lot of the pictures that you see from the Large Hadron Collider, you'll see a huge mess of particles bending around. Those are particles with low momentum. That's why they bend so much. They don't have very much energy. But there's just a huge number of them right in the center of the detector. And these are really the particles that are pulled out by the strong forces as the protons collide. Now, there's a third force that we understand in the Standard Model, and that's called the weak force. It's mediated by two particles that are about 100 times heavier than the proton. They're called the W particle and the Z particle. Because they're heavy, they can only operate over very short distances. The Z particle, other than that, acts a lot like, you know, like light would, like an electric charge interaction would. It just brings things, they feel a little attraction or repulsion. There's one particle, the neutrino, that's the fourth circle over here, the gray one, that only interacts through the weak force, not the others. But the W is a much more curious particle. It actually exchanges the up quark for the down quark, something you don't see. In electric interactions, an electron stays an electron. But in the interactions through the W, the up quark can change into the down quark, and an electron can change into the neutrino. Now, we understand this as arising from a kind of hidden symmetry in the interactions, something that's not transparent, but in a subtle way relates the electron with the neutrino. These two seemingly very different particles do have a kind of hidden symmetry that makes them similar. So this W exchange, because it changes particles around, lets you do funny things. Like a down quark can change into an up quark with a W connecting to it, and then that W decays to an electron and a neutrino. This is the way physicists talk about it, draw it, but it might be simpler to just view it as a chemical reaction. Down going into an up quark, electron, and an antineutrino. And then if you just imagine two other quarks sitting around for the ride, this looks like a neutron decaying into a proton, an electron, and an antineutrino. And this is the process that we see in nature. Free neutrons decay about once every 8 minutes on average. But the diagram on the left still presents a real puzzle. I told you that the W is 100 times heavier than the proton. It's much heavier than the mass difference between these quarks. So there's really no way that a down quark could produce a W and an up quark and still conserve energy. There's just not enough energy in that down quark to do it. So what's going on here turns out to be a really special feature of quantum mechanics, a consequence of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Basically, the uncertainty principle acts a bit like a giant bank. So just like you might borrow some money from the bank in order to buy a house, you can borrow energy from the quantum bank in order to make a W if you don't have enough energy to make it on your own. But the quantum bank's rules are vastly simpler than the rules of any real-life monetary bank. In fact, there's only one rule, which is that the more energy you want to borrow, the less time you're allowed to borrow it for. And there's one universal constant that applies to this everywhere you see it in the world. The amount of time that you can borrow energy for is this constant, Max Planck's constant, divided by the amount of energy you're borrowing. So if, in a very short amount of time, you can borrow the W and exchange it for an electron and a neutrino, and then give the money back to the quantum bank, this process can occur. And the reason it's slow is precisely that you do need to borrow a huge amount of energy and use it efficiently in order to make it go forward. Now, what has this theory bought us? It connects the three very different looking forces to make them actually look very similar. But I think there's something even more important that this theory has achieved. And if we were outside right now, you'd see it directly overhead. You see, Newton told us why the Earth orbits around the Sun, because of gravity. And there are many things about gravity that we still don't understand. But nobody had any clue up to the middle of the 20th century why the Sun actually shone, why it bathes us in light. And this turns out to be a consequence, really, of these three forces acting together: the electric force, strong force, and weak force. So most of the Sun is made up of hydrogen. And that hydrogen burns up into heavier elements through the combination of the three forces. We can just look at one pair of protons inside of the Sun and ask what would happen to them, the protons at the center of two hydrogen atoms. So first of all, the electric force repels equal charges from each other. Protons have the same charge, they get pulled apart. Now, the strong force at very short distances is enough to make the protons want to stick together a little bit, but not enough to make that combination stable. For that, you need the weak force, which actually changes that proton into a neutron. This is the reverse of the process I just showed you. Change the proton into a neutron, a neutrino, and a positron. And the neutron doesn't feel the electric repulsion. It's still bound by the strong interaction to the nearby proton. So that chunk together, that's a deuterium nucleus. And that is the basis for all the further nuclear reactions that happen in the Sun and that give us light. Now, I've said this with a lot of confidence, like I know exactly what's going on deep inside the Sun where I can't see anything. So why do I have any right to do that, you should ask. And the reason I'm doing that is that one of these two products of that process is really special. So every time a deuterium nucleus is formed, it comes with a positron and a neutrino. Positrons, they find electrons and they annihilate. That's what they do in a gas of hydrogen. And that turns into light that gets spread through the Sun, ultimately reaches us, but takes quite a while to. The neutrino, on the other hand, because it only interacts with the weak interactions, basically isn't affected by the matter around it. And it can travel straight back to the Earth, straight out of the Sun. Some of them reach us, and some of them can be measured in giant neutrino telescopes, enormous vats of water or other chemicals, like the one at Snow Lab here in Ontario. Now, we can, on the one hand, calculate the energy of neutrinos that we expect from this reaction and from all the other reactions that go on in the Sun, and how often each reaction should happen. We can also measure the energies of the neutrinos in these giant telescopes up at Snow Lab. And the two match astoundingly well. So that's why, with the neutrinos, we can really see inside the Sun and know what's happening there. Now, this is also the same physics that we see in many other places: in generating nuclear energy, in radiation therapy, and finally, in heating up the inside of the Earth that actually gives us volcanoes and earthquakes. These forces are really all around us, although usually in ways that are hard to recognize. Now, I initially showed you this table with many more elements than the ones I talked about. And these are basically, the second and third rows of this table are basically copies of the first row. There are two new quarks that are a little heavier, two that are a lot heavier. These are called the charm quark, the strange quark, the top quark, and the bottom quark. They're just names. And there's heavier copies of the electron too, the muon and the tau. Now the muon, you can actually see. In fact, you can go and see muons out at Physica Fantastica later this afternoon, or maybe you already have. The other ones though, these are really, really fast decaying particles. Most of them live only a nanosecond or so. And they just decay back into the ordinary step up. Up quarks, down quarks, electrons, neutrinos. They don't live long enough to really play a role in the everyday world. So we aren't very familiar with them, but to physicists, they have been invaluable tools in understanding detailed properties of the weak interactions. And they're invaluable to us today in trying to understand how to get beyond this model. This is a really powerful theory. It's explained a lot of things. It's unified forces and matter together in a single picture. But questions still remain, big questions that we don't understand about how the universe works. And I'm going to highlight just three of them, not necessarily the biggest ones, but three that the LHC has a good chance of shedding some light on. And one of them at first seems to have nothing at all to do with particles. If you look out in the sky, stars are clumped into galaxies. You might ask why that is, and the first answer that many of us would come up with is actually wrong. We'd think that the stars pull each other together gravitationally, just like the Earth pulls all of us down gravitationally and the Sun pulls the Earth in. The stars just pull each other, and that you'd think would be enough to make galaxies. But we can actually look at these individual groups of stars and see how fast they're moving and use that to weigh all the galaxy inside of them. So we've weighed the Milky Way, we've weighed a whole bunch of galaxies, and we know that the matter, the ordinary stuff, the stars and the gas inside of them, doesn't seem to be enough to make these stars move as fast as they do. There's some other stuff that seems to be missing in there. And we really don't know what it is. There's good reasons to think that it probably has to be a new kind of particle, something outside the periodic table that I showed you, a new element, if you will. And we've already given it a name. We call it dark matter. But the fact that it has a name shouldn't fool you. We have no idea what this thing is. We have a lot of guesses, a lot of experiments to test these guesses, but we still don't know what it is. A second problem that's really fundamentally tied to what the LHC will test, because it has to do with colliding particles together. Just think in your mind of scattering two of these W particles together. And really, this works with other particles too. Now, equipped with the standard model, you can calculate not what will happen in each and every collision. That's a quantum thing. And we can only calculate probabilities, but we can calculate the probabilities of different types of things happening when they scatter. And these predictions, at high energies, they start making no sense. You start calculating a probability that's bigger than 100%. So probabilities can't be greater than 100%. That means this theory is deeply broken. It needs to be fixed. It needs to be changed. And the key to understanding what needs to be changed is that the masses of the W, the Z, the masses of all the matter particles, those are what are causing the problem. So those masses have to have a really specific origin in order to reconcile the theory that has worked so well in many arenas, but doesn't really deeply make sense at higher energies. So many of you have heard of the Higgs particle, or the Higgs boson. And it is the simplest proposal for what could solve this problem. To give you at least a rough idea of how this particle solves the problem, we have to go back to how physicists really think about particles, which is a little counterintuitive. Particles we now think of as being intimately related to something called a field. So I'm sure many of you have put a magnet up to iron filings. You see the filings line up. Those are tracing the lines of a magnetic field. In the same way, we think the electron has a field. We think the Higgs has a field. And a particle is just the smallest possible wave, the smallest possible moving wiggle in that field that moves along through space. Fields can also just have a density that fills all the space equally. And other particles that interact with that field, those interactions are going to change their masses. So the Higgs field is a field like this, one that we think has a density everywhere in space. But that field, too, should have some associated particle or particles. And they might decay rapidly, they might decay slowly, we don't know. There might be one, there might be many. But somehow, the fact that all particles' masses can come from their interaction with this Higgs field is absolutely key to resolving this problem of the W particle scattering. That's a Higgs particle moving through. And the gist is that if you repeat this calculation of scattering with a Higgs, the one that gave us nonsense answers before, well, you've got two effects that are canceling each other out. The one causing the problem is the mass of the particle. And the mass, if it's coming entirely from the Higgs field, is proportional to whatever charge, whatever Higgs charge a given particle has. So a top has a bigger Higgs charge and hence a really big mass. An electron has a small Higgs charge and a small mass. The effects of the Higgs particle in the calculation depend on that same coupling, that same Higgs charge. And so those can precisely compensate. When you go through the details of the calculation, those can precisely compensate for the problem that the mass was causing. Now I want to stress, because many people talk about the Higgs particle like, even though we haven't discovered it, we already know exactly what it is. And I think that's deeply misleading. In fact, there are many variations that people have thought of, probably many variations that people haven't thought of exactly how this mechanism works. We really don't know that. All we know is that whatever this field is, it's really crucial to the way the world actually works. Because without it, electrons wouldn't have mass, protons would be heavier than neutrons, so they'd decay into neutrons. There wouldn't be atoms at all, nothing would be as we know it. Now, the last problem that I'll mention is perhaps the least concrete, but it's one that has guided theoretical work for the last 30 years, so I ought to mention it. What I've drawn here is what I'll call a logarithm line. So each mark on this line is a power of 10. In other words, the electron is 1,000 times less massive than the proton. 1,000 is 10 times 10 times 10, 3 times. So the electron is 3 dashes over to the left of the proton. And as you go up to higher energies, more powers of 10 increases in energies. As you go to the left, decreases in decreasing energies or increases in increasing distances. Now, this is a bit of a counterintuitive plot if you haven't seen one before, but it's useful because it lets you compress vast ranges onto the size of a computer screen. So I can simultaneously show you how much bigger a person is than a proton, and actually the same separation between what I've called the W and Z mass and the quantum gravity scale. What I mean by that quantum gravity scale is that just like you can collide protons together to make a W particle, we think that at high enough energies, you could collide protons together and make a black hole. This kind of process, the physics that underlies it, has been vastly clarified by Stephen Hawking's work. But this scale, where black holes can be produced, this is a real number, folks. This is 100 quadrillion times bigger than the mass of the W and Z particles. So that's as big a difference as between the proton and a human being. And to the left of the W and Z, we pretty much understand what's going on. But up above, we have no idea. Actually, there's one thing we know up above that makes this problem, this 100 quadrillion number, seem even more surprising. And that is that in quantum mechanics, we can actually calculate pieces of the W mass. So we say that the W mass has two pieces, a classical piece and a quantum piece. The quantum piece basically comes from lots of heavy particles that you can borrow for a short amount of time from out of nothing that actually change the mass. And its value, its size, is expected to be some number. The detailed number depends on what theory you actually have, all the way between us and the gravity scale, which we don't really know. But some number times the largest mass in the world, the largest mass of any fundamental particle, which we think should probably be close to this quantum gravity scale, 100 quadrillion or so times bigger than the W and Z masses. So M quantum should probably naively be at that scale. So you do a calculation. There's two ways this calculation could work. We want to get a mass in units of the W mass. We want to get the answer 1. Okay? But our quantum correction is a couple hundred quadrillion, roughly, give or take, a few quadrillion. So that can cancel a classical piece out to the 16th to 17th decimal point. They're exactly the same down to the 17th decimal point, and then they differ by 1, and that's where the W mass comes from. Just a cancellation of two nearly equal numbers 100 quadrillion times bigger. Now, that's not a very satisfying explanation. The only other alternative is a very, very crucial one, very inspiring in a way. It's that this number in front of the largest mass of any particle in the world has to be a really small number, 100 quadrillionths, or whatever the number is. And that tells you that the theory, the quantum field theory, starting just above our heads, just above the W mass, at energies that we're starting to probe at the LHC, has to be a really special theory, a theory where that number that you calculate is actually pretty close to 0. So that kind of thinking has inspired models like supersymmetry, Technicolor. You've probably heard these names, and I unfortunately can't tell you more about them in the time I have today. But many speculative proposals, and some of the most exciting and profound things that we could learn at the LHC, if they're true, are really inspired by this puzzle. So these are three things that we hope we might learn about. What's the dark matter that pulls galaxies together? And what takes this deeply predictive but fundamentally inconsistent theory, the Standard Model, and really makes it work, holds it together? And to answer these, a lot of the answers might be lying at energies just a little bit higher than we've been able to reach so far. So the last colliders were about 3.5 times less powerful than the LHC in terms of energy, the Tevatron collider running at Fermilab. And the LHC, by going higher than that, has the opportunity to create previously unknown states of matter. So let's go take a quick tour of where the magic's happening in Geneva, Switzerland. And on this map, you see in the lower right-hand corner, that's the Geneva Airport, completely dwarfed by the size, the 8.5-kilometer wide ring of the LHC, which straddles the border between France and Switzerland. Now, what do the protons see? Well, the protons actually go through a series of little rings, the ones I've highlighted in this plot of the entire CERN campus. The booster, proton synchrotron, each one gets the protons to somewhat higher energies before they move on to the next bigger, higher energy ring. Second to last one, SPS, the superproton synchrotron, is actually where these W and Z particles were first discovered. And now it's a sort of preliminary stage for protons moving on to the LHC. So they get injected into the LHC, half of them going clockwise, half of them going counterclockwise. They bend around, go around in circles, get accelerated in the LHC, and eventually collide at four points along the edges. I'll show you two of those points later on. But first, what actually accelerates the particles in the LHC? You might think that it's these magnets, the iconic blue magnets of the LHC that everybody sees. It's actually not true. All the acceleration happens over here in the French countryside near Echevinex. And there's this tube, this metal tube. Basically, it's called a radio frequency accelerating cavity. But the fundamental principle of it is the same as Thomson's cathode ray tube. Just apply a big voltage to move the protons forward. What do the magnets do? The magnet's job is to get the protons back around the ring again. And as I said, these are the highest energy proton beams in the world. And these magnets are top-of-the-line magnets, the highest field one can build reliably today. Even so, each magnet can only bend the protons over the 15 meters of length of the magnet. They only bend them by 7 centimeters off to the side. So the LHC, yes, it's gigantic, but it's actually as small as it could possibly be to get the protons around the circle. Now, as they bend around, they run through the ring for about 20 minutes, getting accelerated. And after that, they alter the orbits slightly so that the beams actually collide. They collide at the detectors about 20 million times a second. So the kind of technology that was used before to measure particle collisions just doesn't work very well. Until a few decades ago, most collisions were studied in these things called bubble chambers, big vats of superheated liquid with cameras around them. And a particle going through would leave a bubble of gas at places along its path and fill out a little track inside the bubble chamber that one could see. But you have to pump these things between collisions to get a clean picture again. And at the LHC, the collisions happen 20 million times a second. So that wasn't going to cut it. Of course, similarly, that didn't cut it at many generations of accelerators before. What's been developed instead is sort of a special purpose digital camera, not one that measures light like an ordinary camera, but one that measures more subtle effects of the particles going through it. And here you see some pictures of the compact muon solenoid, one of the large detectors at the LHC and the heaviest among them. It's called compact because it's actually a relatively small detector, even though it's heavier than the Eiffel Tower. You see this pipe in the center. That's where protons are going through, in one side and out, and in the other side, to collide right in the center of this big detector. And on the bottom there, you can just barely make out a person, gives you an idea of the scale of this thing. It's actually 16 meters across. And on the side, I have a picture of the beautiful inner layer, which is just made of silicon, relatively tiny, and of the cap that goes at the end of the detector. So it's like a cylinder with two walls. This is on the either side, and this is one of the walls. This is out in the French countryside. Again, just to give you an idea of how big, in human terms, how big this ring is. It's a 20-minute drive into the French countryside in order to actually get from the main campus of CERN to CMS. What's CMS looking for, or the other detectors? Well, most of the particles produced at the LHC are very unstable. They decay almost instantly into the more familiar particles, or the slightly less familiar particles, things like electrons and muons. Now, each particle can decay in a couple of different ways. There's a randomness to it. You can make identical Z particles, and they'll decay differently every time. But there's basic patterns that are distinctive. So for example, about 3% of the time, a Z will decay to a muon and an antimuon, and another 3% to an electron and a positron. And one can infer from their energies and their angles what the mass of that, what mass they would have come from. And it always lines up to the Z mass. So these are sort of the signatures of different particles. They don't last long enough to see them directly. But they leave their characteristic trace on the particles that are left, the particles they produce. They're not necessarily unique, as I'll show you, but they're distinctive enough that one can kind of use them to figure out in reverse what particles you must have been producing in the past. This is just a schematic map of the same detector going out from the center to the outer parts. It's 16 meters wide. And the inner part is a silicon detector that's basically just replacing the bubble chamber, keeping the tracks of where charged particles are going through. Then two layers that measure their energies. And finally, the outer layer that produces the magnetic fields and where muons are observed. And again, the reason the detectors are big is basically the same reason that the LHC is big. One doesn't need to bring the particles around in a circle, but in order to measure them precisely, you do want to have a big magnetic field over a big distance in order to measure how much they bend. And that's what the detectors do. So here again, this is the same event I showed you at the beginning. at the center of the particles from the strong interactions. And now I want to draw your attention to the nearly straight lines of the high energy particles, the two muons going up towards the top of the event, all the way out of the detector, and electrons leaving all their energy in that green layer. So you see the big spikes associated with them. Now, all of the Canadian LHC effort is actually on another experiment, not CMS, but ATLAS, the one that's closest. This is actually right across the street from the main CERN lab, which is over to the left. ATLAS is to the right, and it is the largest detector, but lighter than CMS, because the outside part is mostly air. And here you see their magnet and muon detector superstructure while it was being built. Now, I mentioned how fast these collisions were happening earlier, 20 million times a second. So if you kept track of each of those digital pictures that ATLAS takes, every hour that would fill up 1.5 million Blu-ray discs. And to put it in more familiar terms for those of us who haven't adopted Blu-ray yet, it's 70 billion books every hour that the LHC would write. So you select out, don't want to keep these events, but you do want to keep these events. The one where the Z decays into high energy particles, many of them. And that's done by a series of steps. First some specialized hardware, then thousands of PCs sorting through one event at a time with about 1 millisecond to decide which events they want to keep, which events they want to throw out. Now I want to get to the physics of what we're actually doing with these collisions. I mentioned this problem that needs a Higgs particle or something like it in order to solve it. How is W scattering consistent at high energies? The standard model's broken. What fixes it? This is a difficult idea to test because we don't really have the right tools at our disposal. And I want to explain to you what I mean by that. Remember, a particle's mass is determined by its Higgs charge. The heavier the particle, the higher the Higgs charge. The lighter the particle, the smaller the Higgs charge. You make photons by manipulating things with electric charges, not neutral things. You make Higgs particles by colliding particles with big Higgs charges. The things with the biggest Higgs charges don't last very long. They're things like the top quark, the W, and the Z boson. They all decay really fast. The things we're made of are the things with really low masses, the up and down quarks and the gluon. So how do we make these Higgses? We're made out of the wrong stuff. The right stuff decays too fast. So we have to borrow from the quantum bank again. This is why producing a Higgs particle is actually kind of hard. The gluons inside the proton don't have a Higgs charge, but they do talk to the top quark. They can collide and produce top quarks. They don't even have to go to the mass of the top quark. They can borrow the top quarks and then use those top quarks to again produce the Higgs. So the LHC is a quantum top collider. And by colliding these quantum tops to make a Higgs, we can produce events that, depending on the Higgs mass, they might look either like the one on the left or the one on the right. And these are actually very special events. Because it's a quantum process, producing Higgses is really quite rare. So a W boson, for example, you produce 150 each second at the LHC. They're cheap. Top quarks, one every 2 seconds, still pretty good. A Higgs boson, you might only produce 5 a minute. And if you look for the ones that decay to this in the way I showed on the right, that's an even rarer decay that's also a quantum process. So you only get one of those once every 3 hours. Well, great, you say. We've been running the LHC for a year. We've been running a lot more than 3 hours. So why don't we know what the Higgs is yet? Well, it comes back to these counterfeit signatures. There's a lot more fake Mona Lisas than there are real Mona Lisas, and there's a lot more fake Higgses than real Higgses. So there's many other processes that can mimic either of these signatures, but aren't the real Higgs. What you need to do is look for the one distinctive tell that says that it's really a Higgs, and that is that some fraction of the events will all line up at a particular mass. So here in gray, you see what's expected from the ordinary, the counterfeit Higgses. And then the different colored blobs are what you might see from production of a Higgs at a particular mass. They'd all line up, reconstructing whatever the mass of the Higgs is, whether it's low or high or somewhere in the middle. Now, I talked about looking for a Higgs by using its decay products. But that doesn't work for dark matter. We know that there's still dark matter in the galaxy, so it can't decay. And it also wouldn't interact with in the detector. It's dark. So the way we see dark matter is actually by looking at everything else. Let's say that you're producing dark matter in the detector, but you also produce something else. Say a gluon, this carrier of the strong interaction. Now, the gluon will give you a spray of particles going one way. The dark matter goes the other way. You don't see it. What you do see is that there's some imbalance in the event. Everything you can see that's visible is going one way, so you know there has to be something invisible going the other way. And the same trick works. This is an actual event of this sort. There's a little yellow dot of that gluon spray. You can achieve the same effect if dark matter is produced in the decay of some other particle, as is shown here. Now, this is a difficult kind of search to do, too. Again, there's a counterfeit, and here the real culprit is our old friend, the neutrino. Not such a friend right now, because it makes up the same signature. It's also invisible in the detector. And you see lots of neutrinos, lots of this effect called missing energy coming from neutrinos running off in the direction you can't see. But what you look for is if there's characteristically more events with this imbalance than you would expect, just based on our theory of the neutrinos. And this is a powerful way of learning not just that there is dark matter, but how it interacts with the known particles. So the basic program of LHC searches runs in these two ways that I've illustrated, even for many more kinds of particles than I had time to talk about. Many of them decay into combinations of other particles. You sort of figure out from the combinations, which are a little distinctive, what kind of phenomenon might have been happening. On the other hand, dark matter isn't observable, but it leaves a clear record indirectly that the events just aren't balanced. So far, the LHC has produced 1 million top quarks in its run and hundreds of scientific papers searching for Higgs, searching for supersymmetry, and many other possible scenarios of geophysics searching for dark matter. And physicists in the experimental collaborations and outside, like me, are all trying to piece together these results, try to see what they mean about the world and what kinds of other things might be hiding in the data waiting to be uncovered. It's a really exciting time to be in this field. And whatever new particles we find, there will be a series of a progression of understanding. First, what's produced, what it's produced with, how it decays, and then trying to understand more deeply the rules and principles that explain this behavior, and what, if any, relation it has to the particle, to the questions that I already mentioned. The rules that we discover this way at the LHC will be fundamentally the same ones that govern what's going on here in this room. Now, a lot of times I'm asked by physicists and non-physicists alike what I expect to find at the LHC. And it's a fair question, but I always hate to answer it, because most of the time, the most interesting things we've learned have come about in surprising ways from studying things we didn't understand. So when Faraday was looking at his arc of light traveling through a gas, nobody could have guessed that this would lead to the discovery that the world is made of particles. And we don't know what will happen at the LHC. Einstein, among many other things, sort of said we don't know what we're doing. We never know what to expect, but really the same feeling. Most of the important things in physics come to us as surprises, and hopefully we'll learn many things about the questions that we've asked, that we already know are important. Hopefully we'll also learn some things that are more surprising, more fascinating than we ever could have imagined. So stay tuned, and thanks a lot for your time.
That was certainly the most eloquent walk through the LHC physics I've ever had the pleasure of enjoying. Thank you, Dr. Torrell. We're going to open the floor now for questions. If you do have a question, make your way to that aisle and down to the microphone. And as people are making their way, I have a question to start. It's not nearly so grand as where you took us. Back when you were talking about the sun, and photons are created in the sun, and neutrinos are also created, the neutrinos were beating the photons somewhere. Not to Earth, but was that from the inside of the sun outside?
From the inside to the outside, the neutrinos go nearly at the speed of light because their energy is really high. And the light actually sort of bumps around into all of the electrons inside the sun and takes, I think, millions of years, some large amount of time, to actually go from the inside to the outside. So that, even though light travels fast, it gets scattered so much that it takes a very long time.
Thank you. All right, I get a second question. You guys are spoiling me. Second question is this. You mentioned that Dirac unified special relativity with some of quantum theory. Here, obviously, the challenge is to rationalize or to join all of relativity theory with quantum theory. I know you don't like this question, but I just can't help but ask, do you think the LHC data as it's streaming out is going to get us there?
You know, that's actually a great question, and I hope the answer is yes. It might not be. I mean, really, I undersold gravity in this talk. I mean, gravity is the most day-to-day force and the one that on a quantum level we understand the least. We hope we'll get a few hints from the LHC, but they'll probably be indirect ones, because our best guess for the energy where the gravity effects really become important is so much higher than we can actually produce there.
Thank you. And now, another question, please.
Okay, you talked about the Higgs as being the charge carrier of gravity, and other charges I'm familiar with, you know, like electromagnetism, have a polarity to them. Does the theory around Higgs, is there an analog in Higgs? Is there some kind of, you know, is there anti-gravity? Is there a negative charge to the Higgs?
Yeah, so first of all, I want to clear up one thing, which is a lot of times people associate, you know, gravity couples to mass, Higgs couples to mass. So these are very different stories. Gravity, we think, is coupled by a spin, is carried by a spin 2 particle that we know very little about, and it really couples to energy. It's what Einstein found. It's just that most things we interact with have very low momentum. Most of their energy comes from their mass. The Higgs couples just to the masses of specific particles. And there is a notion, to get back to your original question, there is a notion of a sign, but it turns out not to. It is not, I mean, both gravity and the Higgs tend not to have the same kind of repulsive effect that the electric charge does.
Thanks.
Thank you, and I believe we have another wonderful question.
What charge does
no question?
I can't say because it's too loud.
Do you want to just tell us and we'll repeat it for the mic?
Do you have a question? I'll hold it for you. Do you have a question?
What charge does a top quark have?
A top quark has an electric charge, which is 2/3 the charge of a proton. And then if you think about the Higgs charges, it also has a big Higgs charge. So there's lots of other forces that it has charges under. But under the force we're most familiar with, electromagnetism, its charge is 2/3 of a proton's.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in congratulating and thanking Dr. Natalia Toro.